Okay, well, so why don't we go ahead and get started? I will call this meeting to order. On the phone we have Jonah Schwartz, myself, Jim Hennessy, Paige McGillaway, Gene Langendorf, Mark Gold, and then Ashley Schweikart, and Belinda Carlton from the Texas Council on Developmental Disabilities has also dialed in to listen to our discussion. So, welcome to everyone. Has everyone had a chance to review the minutes from April 30th?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Could I have a motion, please?
I'll make a motion. We accept them.
Okay.
Jim?
Second, Gene.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, I assume we're ready to vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Motion passes. Okay. The next item on our agenda is discussion of the biennial plan recommendations.
Sorry to interrupt. We also have approval of the May 13th meeting minutes.
Oh, so we do. I'm sorry. I apologize.
It's okay.
Yes, we do. Okay. All right. So may I have a motion, please, for the May 13th minutes?
Move approval. Gene.
Second.
Ms. Jim, I'll second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any abstentions?
This is Paige. I will, just because I wasn't on the call. I don't know if that's proper protocol. I've read that one, though. It sounds like y'all did a lot of work.
Okay. All right. Motion passes. Thank you very much. Okay. Discussion of biennial plan recommendations. I assume that everyone has had an opportunity to look at the handout that Ashley prepared, the discussion handout. So for the preliminary policy recommendations, Ashley, do you want to give us some background on this?
Sure. Basically, we had at our May 13th conference call, it was decided by the committee that members could submit preliminary recommendations by email and CC the rest of the committee, and then that's how I created the discussion handout. And basically, I tried to put in any types of back and forth that we had over the over email about certain issues also in there. So as you can see, trying to avoid duplication if anyone, you know, was agreeing with the same recommendation again, I think that we came up with 11 recommendations that were either related to policy or to funding. And so I guess we can go through them. We want to go through them one by one, and if there was any discussion to be had or to kind of flush out the meaning behind the preliminary recommendations, we should probably go through that way. So should I start? Should I just start from the number one?
That sounds good to me.
All right. Yeah. So the first one that was a preliminary recommendation submitted was to establish or increase a disability set-aside in developments and tie direct funding from trust fund or home to support the development of affordable units with appropriate modifications. Developer would need to establish a relationship with Medicaid provider for support services. And for this one and for number two, actually I should probably read them together. There was a little bit of back and forth about the Medicaid aspect. So number two is explore the use of TDHCA home funds for community housing development organizations for the purchase of housing for lease to low-income individuals in partnership with Medicaid waiver service providers. And so when the discussion that came up, and I'm sure you all saw it, was, you know, that there can't be any kind of exclusive relationship between the developer and the I think it was the service provider, because I think that what the comment was is that Medicaid providers cannot solicit, nor can individuals be directed to specific providers.
And actually, that was my comment.
Right. Yeah, and so there, you know, the back and forth after that was, you know, trying to have housing developers be knowledgeable about the Medicaid programs and services, and for Medicaid providers at the same time be aware of the housing opportunities. So I think that was maybe the intent of the quote unquote partnership with Medicaid waiver service providers.
And this is Jean. I never meant it to be exclusive. I just think it's really important if we're going to try to increase the disability set-aside or any kind of linkages, is that we really hold the developers accountable to have something, some kind of established understanding. Because in the past, I know when we've had certain set-asides recommended, the scoring of it has pretty been kind of loose. I mean, so I think we'd have to really have there be a way of measuring that they understand that whole connection, that it's just not a loosely, you know, okay, well, I know people with disabilities or something like that. I hate to say it that broadly, but that's what I meant. I never meant that they should be in cahoots with just one, you know.
And I'm wondering, I don't know, again, how y'all do your program. Often when we do in the human service world, we call them requests for proposal, that when we have a bid or there's something going on, we'll have known as a bidders conference. And at the bidders conference, we really do provide more intensive information. And whether or not we can tie this into some participation where then there could be sort of a systematic education or 5-10 minutes or a discussion of what human services and services are like, just to get them at least grounded in that conversation.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that for TDHCA programs, if it's a notice of funding availability going out, then there will be roundtables about that NOFA. If it's a change to program rules, there usually is a public participation process, for example, for the Housing Tax Credit Program or the HOME Program. So there is definitely that public participation opportunity available to hopefully educate those who are potential applicants.
Well, perhaps that's an opportunity. I don't know if we can build this in or we make it formalized or not. It's saying that, you know, individuals have to participate in these events, and that these events will include a section when relevant regarding human services and how you connect up and where all the linkages and who all are available in that time. Because I would think that I would consider the same function as just saying someone needs to have a relationship or, well, relationship's very wrong. We can't have a relationship per se, but at least being knowledgeable about the human services system and who they need to be able to call. And in conjunction to that, you know, we in the human service system have, and we already have lots of information that the individual needs to hand out, sort of generic information to individuals coming into the complex as just those that have it on hand.
Can I ask what might be a very obvious question, but just to clarify the discussion here, I was particularly enamored with item C, but going back up there, was the intent of the discussion something parallel to, for example, what happens in waiver services or some of the others related to informed choice, that if you had a person who was looking for housing, that there was no quid pro quo with a developer between the provider. It was more of the provider was able to say, there's X number of providers who are approved or whatever who are doing this, who are available, who have access to this funding to provide these supports.
Yeah, I
can pick the one you want. I mean, is that...
You've absolutely captured
the
issue.
Yeah.
Is that we have requirements on hand that there can't be any seeding of a particular provider.
Okay.
So a particular thing, the idea that the housing person is providing housing, service person is providing services, there needs to be a linkage so the person then can make informed choice on which of the providers they want. And that's a strict Medicaid regulation.
Yeah, as it is with our federal money, too. And,
right.
But I just want to make sure I was understanding the
case. You got it perfectly.
Okay.
Okay, so, Jean, I know that these two recommendations have been submitted by you. I wanted to know if you wanted to maybe give a little bit of background behind why you had suggested these, or, you know, maybe a little bit more detail.
For one and two?
Sure.
Oh, okay.
Can you talk especially about C? I think I get your point there, but I also want to make sure I understand your point on 2C.
That wasn't mine. That was Mike Goodwin's.
Oh, okay.
But we can talk about it certainly. But, Jean, you want to start first?
Okay.
Yeah, but I would say C actually would be a separate recommendation, not necessarily related to this.
Okay.
I think, for one, definitely there already is the requirement of a certain number of units be developed with certain accessibility features. And so what I'm trying to recommend on the TIE direct funding from the trust fund or home to support the development is more trying to make, as in a tax credit or some of the other funding streams, that some of these funds that can be used to make units affordable in the development, that they're not market rate, that they're not 80% and below, but that they're actually grant money involved in the development to the developer to develop units that can be available to those at 30% and below. So it's more of an increasing that. And again, as I mentioned, the hookup or the relationship or the some way of judging that the developer has contacts or has, I don't know, working with the Independent Living Center, truly. Because what we've seen in the past with tax credits is there are the accessible units, and then I can't tell you the number of tax credit developers that I would run into at conferences and stuff, and they'd go, we've got these accessible units, but we can't find people to live in them. And I'd say, are you familiar with the UCP or the Easter Seals or the Independent Living Center? Well, no. Well, I thought, well, how do people know about it? Or the developments on the edge of town with no transportation, yada, yada, yada. So I think it's really important if we're going to be putting money out there that we have some way of measuring the developers' understanding of how to outreach and find the people to fill up these units.
So, Jean, I have a suggestion because I read that and what came to mind, and I'm not trying to be too bureaucratic, but I mean, what came to mind was, could we require as part of the proposal that the person submits to develop this housing that they have some kind of
partnership.
A partnership or plan between some of the organizations in their community that demonstrates that they've initialized some of these linkages and they know who to go to.
Absolutely. I mean, like the relocation organizations. I mean, I can tell you we have a waiting list of more than 25 individuals with disabilities who need affordable housing. So, again, it would be in the RFP. If you're going after this set-aside or if you're going after this extra points or however the department or TASHAC or anybody wants to operationalize this, we just have to have it measured somehow. I just want to stress that we have to have it measured.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it needs to be more than just a letter of support.
Absolutely. I mean, I can tell you, look at the 811, or if anybody wants to look at HUD's 811, I mean, you are required to provide all kinds of stuff. You know, I mean, there's ways of saying that you have the capacity, and the linkages and the partnerships to actually serve people with disabilities.
Dean, you want to maybe get into that, when you reference 811 and what they require, what kinds of things do they require?
They require that you show you have letters of support from all kinds of service agencies in order to show that you have the community linkages, to show that in 811 we're providing housing, but we're not providing the services, but we have to show that there are agencies that we're partnering with that we will be able to refer people to. So we have to get letters of support.
And Jean, actually, sort of a converse of that, for example, we have a new procurement out for our relocation specialist, our fourth one at this point. But in there, we have a whole section where you have to demonstrate, when you write your application, your linkages to other community support, such as public housing authorities, to the housing, to TIBRA, to all these things. So we can share you that information to the rest of the group here of how we specifically write in, how you have to do it in reverse when you're a human services system.
And Mark, what program were you referring to there with the linkages to PHAs is required?
It is our relocation contractor, our relocation specialist, the ones that are helping to relocate individuals from nursing facilities back to the community. And that is a big part of what we build into our, and we call it an RFP versus a NOFA.
Right.
But that's a huge part. So, and it does reverse. It says, how have you worked with your authorities? How have you worked trying to get vouchers? So we make them respond, and they're monitored for that on an ongoing basis.
Mark, this is Marshall. How are those people chosen?
The relocation specialists? Well, they're evaluated on a variety of different issues and how they are going to respond to all the various aspects of this RFP. But that is one part of this RFP, is that they have some historical, or they can document how they've worked with their authorities in the past, how they participate in local community settings, if they review consolidated plans. We have to demonstrate some experience or knowledge of how they've worked with the housing community.
Can I ask a question? This is Paige, and Jean, I would be interested, because I know even when I was working for THJ, you were always talking about having to verify that organizations had the capacity. And so in your opinion, are the 811 requirements the best that you've seen out there as far as proving that?
Yeah. I mean, truthfully, as far as doing, you really, really have to have letters that, from a lot of different groups that really state their commitment.
Okay.
So I guess that's the best. That's the best that I'm aware of. Now, other states could have implemented things that. North Carolina, again, I love the North Carolina program, but they really have partnered with what would be very similar to what we have in place with our I don't know what they're called now, but MHMR councils, MHMR,
the community centers.
Thank you. With the community centers, that they have the housing people have a relationship, or in order to be part of that program in North Carolina, they have to, there's the linkages proof there. So
Okay. Okay, great. Well, this is, I think that's great. I think that that explains what you meant for number one. And number two, for you talking about the housing for lease for low-income individuals through the
Community Housing Development Organization. Home funds, I know from KDHCA, we get in the home program, there's a certain amount of funds that have to go to CHOTOS. And in the past, I don't know how it is right now, but in the past, it's a federal requirement. If you don't use that 15%, it goes back. I mean, you can't reprogram it. You can't do anything. It goes back to the feds. And I know in the past, it's been difficult for TDHCA to utilize their CHOTO funds. I was just thinking, because there's a certain set aside, because there's CHOTOS that could develop the housing with the special money, there could be the development of housing, and I'm thinking small housing, I'm thinking single family, or I'm thinking duplexes or something of that nature, that would allow for integration, that then could be leased to individuals who are receiving or going to receive or somehow connected with the relocation people or somebody that will receive the actual services. Again, they're separate. The CHOTO people would not be providing the services. They don't do that. They create housing. That it would be a way of developing housing and a funding stream to develop housing.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be a really good way to emphasize getting away from the more apartment or institutional type, we're all in the same place type situation. They have individual homes or duplexes like that. And I think that's a good way to go to a model of saying you can live wherever you want to, and you can live in a house by yourself or with your family or whoever, like everybody else out in the community, and still get these services tied to whatever you're doing without having to say you have to be in some kind of project or,
Right.
Or a set of apartments or something. I think that's a great alternative.
So, Jane, do you think that for, like, the home NOFA for CHOTOS, that would just be would you want to, like, incentivize that in a way? Like, because I know that in the past some home programs have done where for the first, X amount of days that the NOFA is open, it can only go to certain projects to try to incentivize those projects. Would that be something that you're thinking of, or how would you want to incorporate it?
I think that would be great. And for TDHCA, I know, and I might get, sideways with the rural people, or we may have to change some legislation. But
right.
But I know you can use home funds in participating jurisdictions, in other words, urban areas, and CHOTOS. Hopefully, the CHOTO money could be used, if need be. I mean, it could be used it could be used as a something that somebody could do out in the rural areas too. But somehow be incentive. I can't think of the word. I can't do the word. But extra points or set aside to begin with, that the money will be prioritized for the first 60 days for those developing housing integrated for people with disabilities.
Okay. All right. I see that. All right.
Can I come at one other question here? We're talking about, again, this is definitional. When we talk about low income, how are we defining low income for this purpose?
I guess if we're talking about housing activities, then low income is defined as 50% of area median income or below.
50% or 60? 50%, sorry. Because, again, when you talk about this in relationship to waivers, there's a disconnect there.
Okay. How do you mean?
Well, individuals who are eligible for Medicaid waivers are no way going to meet 50% or low.
No, and below.
Yeah.
I mean, the ones I've seen developed are generally for, the lower end. Because it's grant funding in these developments, and it's not like I mean, if you're using home funds, it's not like you're going to have to charge a whole lot of rent necessarily. So it's 50% below, Mark. It's not they have to be at 50%.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Medicaid waivers, I actually have been trying to learn a lot about the eligibility requirements for Medicaid waivers recently. Am I correct in thinking that the financial eligibility is 300% SSI?
You are exactly correct.
Yay! Gold star.
Yeah,
all right.
It starts off at 100% for some programs.
Right.
And it can go up to 300%.
Right.
For the waivers and for institutional.
Okay. Okay. Okay, great. Do we want to talk about 2C then? Maybe as a separate recommendation that Mike Goodwin had put out. Let me read it to everyone. I think that he was recommending having a coordinator or clearinghouse where linkages can be made between housing organizations and service organizations. And he said, one concern is that mainstream housing providers are being left out because there is no link or hook to pull them into this network. Lacking that, nothing really changes. Minor development of small properties oriented only towards elderly or persons with disabilities.
I'm not sure I understand the point that's being made. I apologize.
That's okay. Mike's not here and on this call today.
Right. You know, what I was gathering from it was that, you know, I know in, and that's what I was curious about it. In years past, I think his point is if we don't reach out to mainstream, all those other developers out there who may know nothing of the opportunity to be involved in this, we may get small and not substantial responses. And, you know, when we did supported housing in Pennsylvania, which is somewhat equivalent to service enriched, we just, probably 80% of the properties used of the close to 700 were from general community stock and working with landlords and property developers who knew nothing of this arena. And it took several years to kind of pull them in. So I that's what I was trying to get at is, was it really kind of a point about expanding, making sure that we're reaching out to not just sort of traditional small developers who've done this kind of work, but expanding it.
So it sounds like, well, that's one of the issues that we're trying to achieve, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that maybe if we want to get into the details of how that would be accomplished, I think that would be a really important policy recommendation in here. And, Jim, I don't know if you want to try to use your Pennsylvania experience to say how that was accomplished there for outreach for the general housing developers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we did a lot of, you know, we spent a lot of time networking with builders associations and landlord associations and things along those lines.
Okay.
And did some media work. And the key, I think, ties back to what you guys talked about earlier, and that is having a pretty tight process into which people can plug. You know, that's the first thing you got to do, you know, if you have all your ducks lined up, and then you start inviting other people in. Because if it's not established yet, I think some of the more traditional providers have a higher tolerance for ambiguity than a lot of your private business folks. I don't know if that makes sense, but
when you say the process that people can plug into, what exactly do you mean?
Well, meaning that everything's defined and established and who's in and who's out and what that means to be in. You know, for example, again, apples and oranges, but when we did supported housing, we had pretty well defined our payment structure, how we would negotiate, what the rates were, what either a landlord or a developer had to do to be, you know, to participate in this. Certain assurances they had to give in terms of property and access and things along those lines, and those were all established up front.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we reached out to private providers and landlords, they were able to see what was there and make a decision right away there was some push initially to sort of run out and really recruit folks and then sort of figure it out. And that's all I was saying. So all the discussion you're having seems to be germane to that.
So basically what I was saying is that there's a way that we can do outreach and education to make sure that any possible individual who may not even consider it in the past will perhaps consider it this in the future. And just Well, that makes sounds like one of our objectives and goals for this whole council, and so that sounds great.
But, yeah, but I do think it's distinctly different from what the cross-agency
committee
has been doing. So I think that it should be in this chapter for sure. Okay, great. And Jim, I might want to have another conversation with you, about your experiences, so I can get some more details. Should we go on to recommendation 3, adjustments to the low-income housing tax credit qualified allocation plan to support the development of service-enriched housing?
Well, again, could you explain to me exactly what that is? Because at least within my impression, through preferences and through everything, again, I'm speaking from a housing, maybe I'm up to 3.0 level now, not 101, but there are through preferences and other set-asides that are low-income housing tax credit. Already has that in place, and that, service-enriched housing is just making sure we have enough housing out there, so people who want to bring housing into the situation will be able to do that. So tell me how this would be different than what we're currently doing.
And that's mine, and I do see it as being different. All that tax credits are required to do now, again, it used to be a point thing, and then it got implemented as it was a state law, that they would have to do a certain number, more than what state would require, that they would meet 504. So that's not required in tax credits. So the state law requires that they do meet 504 as far as creating accessible units. That's about all that's being done. What I'm talking more of is that we get units that are, again, tying in some of that home fund or some other way, they get more points. In any kind of development process, I found that if it's points or incentives, it's kind of like build it and they will come, or they follow the points. So if we can make it as something...
you're talking about to further the number of units that are made accessible?
No. I'm talking about those units that would be more affordable.
Oh, affordable. Okay.
Yeah, for people with disabilities or those elderly or those that would need services.
So, Jane, again, I don't want to come off as being dense here. I just want to be making sure I perfectly understand. So is this something above and beyond we are currently doing, or are you saying this isn't done at all at this point?
We have nothing that encourages service-enriched housing.
See, there's one section of the QAP that encourages what they call supportive services, and the list of those services, they're not health-related or like long-term services and supports. They're more like helping people with getting their GED or child.
Exactly. They're not directed towards what we're defining.
Right.
What they're directed towards is you can have a computer lab, you can have, which are not bad services. I'm not trying to say that, but if we're looking at service-enriched, we want to talk about the kind of things we would want to promote.
Right, and that's and so I wanted to make sure that that's what you meant, that there would be some type of points that would be for the services that we've been talking about on this council.
So would that mean that we're going to be giving adjustments, to the tax credit or points or preferences, so then they would be required to provide more information regarding human services, or that they would be actively linking up people with services. Again, it goes back to my confusion of what service-enriched housing actually means. But can you give me a concrete example?
I would see it, again, I keep going back to the North Carolina design, but that they would say, okay, again, it's going to cause them, and hopefully there'll be a pot of money, that they could take the money and develop more units or some units, and I guess we could have a system of points that you get this many points if you're doing 5 units of service-enriched housing, such that in your development of 180, you're going to have 5 units that are going to be affordable at 30% and below. And you're going to do that by the other funding you're going to get or put into it to make those units be affordable. In other words, they're going to be affordable to those at 30% instead of 60% of area median income, which tax credits generally do. And that you're going to have, again, a relationship or some way of providing through relationships with others the services that individuals would be needing. Memorandum of agreement, support letter, something saying you have a relationship with and you're going to be receiving referrals from the community center for those units. And you're going to hold those units for those people. Again, it's the North Carolina model.
And if you've got the relationships already with people, with organizations that are serving these individuals, then your units are not going to sit empty for very long.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of my thinking on this.
Okay.
And again, I know there's points for supported services, and I can almost guarantee you everybody that puts in a tax credit,
yeah,
they need it.
Yeah.
And they go for the points. And some of them, if you read them, it's like, oh, my God, I don't know how they got those points. But it's a, you know.
No, I know what you're saying, and I think that's definitely a recommendation that is realistic in terms of being able to make some type of point part of scoring criteria. And I will definitely look. I know that I've read part of the North Carolina QAP, but I will look at it further to make sure I know exactly what they say.
Now, again, North Carolina comes with money. I mean, their state has set aside money.
Right. Well, yeah, and of course, you know, if we want to make policy recommendations to deal with GR, we can, but that hasn't been touched yet.
Yeah, trust fund. I see GR as trust fund.
Okay. And so in terms of, did you, I know that you did give a recommendation, I believe it's number 5, that was include a priority in the trust fund plan to support the development of service-enriched housing. Would that be given the current money that we have or given an additional allocation?
Oh, I'd love more allocation, but the reality is there would be opportunity to use the current money. I don't, and don't quote me on whose money I'm going after, because I'm not. But you know, it's the will to do it.
So you would say just to make it a priority in the next biennium plan.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Well, that one seems fairly straightforward. Do we have any questions on that, number 5, include a priority in the Housing Trust Fund plan to support the development of service-enriched housing? Does everyone know about the Housing Trust Fund?
Was there really enough money in the trust fund to do all the things that everybody wants to do within the trust fund?
Of course it's not.
Well, I can tell you a little bit of background in terms of in the 81st legislative session, the amount of GR towards the trust fund effectively doubled. However, we also, as all other state agencies did, were given the requirement of cutting our budget, and the 5% cut did come out of the trust fund. I think it will. I don't know if that's actually finalized, because it went to the LVB, and then the LVB makes the final decision about where the cut occurs, I think. Anyway, but yeah, you're right, Mark, though, that the current programs that we have in the Housing Trust Fund are usually only $1 million, $2 million, $3 million programs.
Right. I mean, that's my concern. I mean, the Money and Friends Advisory Committee has recommended last time, I think they're probably recommending this time, that a separate trust fund be set up especially for this sort of activity. To go back again to what Gina said, and I absolutely 1,000% agree with her about the North Carolina model, that we could sort of mimic that somehow. But I just wanted to make sure that if we're asking to put in another hit or another priority on the trust fund, that's not taken away from something that is already underfunded. And what does that mean in a meaningful way?
So what if we somehow or another tied it to the new barrier free money they got, and in some way we created, we thought about, okay, developers, nonprofits get money, getting grants from the barrier free, and then they find clients or people, consumers that need to have their apartment, their house, or something modified, that can use that money if they meet the criteria of income to get that done. So all of those people are going to have a disability. What if there's some way to tie a certain percentage of those into services, coordination, or some way that since there are any accidents in that population anyway?
I don't know about that, Marshall. I don't necessarily see that connection. I'm very much for just making more of a priority for this particular initiative. I mean, obviously somebody felt that there was a need legislatively to have this council put together. So hopefully we're going to come up with recommendations and I'm kind of not trying to analyze whether or not there's enough money out there. I'm just here to say, okay, this is what we need to do. I don't know. And I'm not at all married to any of the language in here. If somebody wants to say it better, I want to put that out there. So if it's not...
I don't disagree with you with the concept. I mean, the concept is an excellent concept that we use every sort of funding source we can to try to support increasing housing stock for this population. So I don't disagree with you. Those were just my more fundamental bureaucratic concerns is, you know, is there enough money? Are we taking away from something else? I suppose you can always pass a recommendation and you hope that at some point, someplace, probably not this legislative session, but some future session will come in and increase appropriations to the trust fund, or set up a separate one just to address this particular issue.
And I think that the plan will, you know, if anyone reads it, one would hope that one
will
read it. Who knows on that? I know that sometimes our plans get thrown on shelves, but if we can make someone read it, they would notice that all of our best practice examples that we will be having in their very own chapter on best practices, I think almost all of them have a significant general revenue appropriation to make them happen. Just like the North Carolina model, New Jersey model, I think that is a continued theme throughout our best practice examples that would be hard to overlook if you were reading it and you were a legislative aide.
But the reason I said that about the very free stuff is that it seems that one of the things that probably drove the people's perception of a need for this council and these being put together is they have been so disjointed in the past. We've had programs for housing, we've had programs for services, and neither of the two shall meet, almost. And so anything we bring forward, and of course, we can ask for new money and money for new programs, but if we could also show here are some existing programs that we could somehow work together better, I think as a legislature, they'd say, hey, that's a good idea. Let's try to use do both of them, new money and then coordinating things that are already out there better.
Okay. Do we want to then, well, we skipped number four, so maybe I should go back to number four. Although I think that this is somewhat similar to number three, which is using bond funding to be directed to support the development of service-enriched housing. And Jean, you meant the 4% bonds?
Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah.
Or TSAC bonds, anybody's bonds, I don't care. just some of these have priorities, or some of these, you know, put it in there that this is something we need to do. And Mark, if you all have something for promoting independence, I don't think it'd be bad to have it in that and this report recommendations too.
No. We certainly wanted to have duplicate areas. I mean, I too write this spectacular report, and I think it is a spectacular report. I'm not sure how many people ever read it. It always frustrates me when I go to meetings and stuff. I said, well, that information was in the PIEC report, the Promoting Independence Plan. Did you read the plan? But I think it's always worth putting in as many areas, and then it really is dependent on advocates for this program as they go down to the legislature to say, well, it's been made in several places and to do that. So it's not against any of the stuff. It's just... again, what's realistic and what we can get in. So we certainly plan to include it in the Promoting Independence Plan. And again, as much as possible, we'd like to have the language look pretty consistent so people can say it's coming from different areas, but it's the same story.
So, Mark, if you could, the housing... recommendations for the current PIC plan, are you saying that there's some key factors of what we're looking at right now that are overlapping that we should maybe point out are overlapping?
Well, I don't know if you want to say it's overlapping, but...
Well, in conjunction.
In conjunction, sure. I mean, I think that just helps strengthen, as you say, when you do, if we get an opportunity or people get an opportunity to talk to a legislative aide to make that interconnection. I think that makes for a stronger message.
So do you see something in this discussion handout that we can, you know, already point to as kind of like the in-conjunction recommendations?
I think certainly the housing, the trust fund
okay.
is certainly one of those areas. Sure.
Okay, great. All right. So I guess we can keep going. So recommendation number six, explore how TSHAC can partner with the National Disability Opportunity Fund as partner nonprofits to bring funding opportunities to Texas. And that, Paige, maybe this is the time for you because I do not know anything about the Disability Opportunity Fund.
Yeah, and I think that Jean had put in that particular one.
Right.
As far as TSHAC, any time TSHAC is written in any of these recommendations, you know, I think that we're in full support and willing to do whatever it takes to make an attempt to fulfill these needs if we can. So I just want to throw that out there. But so, Jean, can you just tell us a little bit about what the fund is? Because I'm not familiar with it at all either.
Yeah, and it's a new CDFI, Community Development,
okay.
Finance institution. I think that's what CDFI stands for.
That's right.
It's a national CDFI that is established to assist nonprofits across the country in developing services and housing. They came to Austin and had one of their board members is from Austin, and they came and they want to do business in Texas. CDFI provide financing. It's kind of, you know, the Wall Street effort. There are people that were on Wall Street, happen to be parents of a child with a disability, and have decided to devote their life to this new nonprofit, CDFI. They want to partner with nonprofits in Texas. I mean, they're really in the early stages. They've done some financing of schools that serve people with disabilities in other states, and they've done some financing for families who got together and wanted to buy a house, other things of that nature. But it just happened to come up recently, and I thought, well, you know, we might as well try to get them to Texas, and their likely partner would be with TSHAC as a statewide nonprofit.
Sure, and it's, you know, even before this plan comes out, if you have any connection to that or a contact, maybe we should try to, you know, coordinate a meeting of some kind to begin.
Yeah, and they also have involved the One Star Foundation in this initiative to get the word out to nonprofits. So we might want to, you know, have a meeting on this. But it was just something I thought, if we could try to see how we could bring them to Texas.
And show them how friendly we are.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love it. I think that's great.
All right. Recommendation 6 done. Recommendation 7, explore how TSHAC can partner with private foundations to support the development of service-enriched housing.
Yeah, Jean had written that in there, too, and I think that we are currently doing that through our Texas Foundations Fund and would love to be able to do more of it, and we are certainly looking at that. It just comes down to funding, but by all means, it needs to be in the plan.
Okay.
And are we talking, is the discussion about getting funding from foundations or establishing a foundation that would actually be living off using funds that it developed through its own work?
No, I think TSHAC is a statewide nonprofit that can go after foundation funding,
right.
And I just thought they'd be a good vehicle.
And for our foundation, we have a Texas Foundations Fund, which has a set aside for service-enriched, housing that provides enriched services, and not just resident services like the GED stuff. We do, ours is very specific, so.
But the foundation funds off its interest, not its corpus, right?
We have to seek out the funding for that fund.
Oh, okay. I guess then, all right, that makes sense. I was thinking of a lot of nonprofits, including some ones that I've been with, will establish their own foundation, and they will solicit funds to put in that foundation.
Right, and we
that foundation will fund programs off its interest.
And that's what we would love and maybe someday hope to get to, but we're such small change. We only do $250,000 every year, and I think that in order to have, you know, kind of like a trust fund, it needs to be over $1 million.
Yeah.
So
you generally need about $1 million to start a corpus.
We've certainly explored that and would love for it to become something like that, but we're going to do what we can in the meantime.
Okay.
Okay. So this goes, so that recommendation is more of a furthering current efforts.
Well, I mean, we're willing to explore other ways, you know, to provide service housing, but that's one that we're currently doing, but we're willing to, you know, look at more if people think that we need more.
Okay.
Within our capacity.
Okay. All right. Number 8, a recommendation number 8 is fund housing navigators through independent living funding or a state funding source who would work at the local level to match those with waiver or other community support services who need housing to be in the community.
I think we kind of do this in a small way currently. I mean, part of the relocation contractor's responsibility is to kind of housing navigate. Now, it's not their full-time job, but it's something that they do. And I think there's some activity, although it's, again, small centers for independent living, but it's certainly not a bad recommendation to do something like this.
And just to let you know, I mean, this is a little bit of overlap with the cross-agency committee. And they had some talk about how currently there is a specialist on the service side that goes through a series of trainings with the AAAs and can become, what's it called, Mark? Like a certified?
counselor.
Right.
And that's for services. And so they were thinking, like, can there be kind of like a similar, like, training and certification process for a housing specialist using the same established connections that are already from state to local level, maybe through the AAAs or through ADRCs or what have you, to establish a housing specialist. I think this one is slightly different in that this is about having a funding source to make sure that housing link up happens.
Well, I mean, it'd be great if we can find it. There are certain things that we're doing on a smaller level that's trying to accomplish this. It would be nice to have a systematic way of doing that. And for example, the Money for the Person demonstration, we've just submitted a request for 100% funding to do actually this sort of activity. Now, it won't be on a statewide basis, obviously, but it would be on a pilot basis.
Okay.
It sounds like, I understand, right, this is part of what the rehabilitation specialist does, too.
It's part of what they do. It's definitely part of what they do. It's not 100% of what they do, but it's definitely part of what they do. They're supposed to, one, to identify whether or not, and these are for individuals now, who are in an institutional setting and are relocating. It doesn't include all individuals with disabilities who are currently living in the community, but they're supposed to be aware of what the TBRA functions are, project access, and supposed to know a little bit about the developers and the units in their local area. But again, it's not a full-time job just for housing.
And so, Mark, with the Money Follows the Person, you're doing a pilot of this nature.
We requested funds to do something. Yes.
Okay. And that request for funding is through CMS.
It's through CMS.
Okay.
But I think it's an excellent recommendation, and certainly something like that's needed. We had actually tried contacted, though he never contacted back, John Hennenberger, to see if we could get someone to go out and help make sure that website actually was up to date. And we were willing to look at that. Like I said, we never heard back from him about doing something to actually. So we thought, well, just having a housing navigator, because part of the responsibility will be to looking at local units to make sure that they're up to date, that's on the registry, is working. That alone, we thought, would be a useful and meaningful activity.
Okay. We can go on. The next one, I know this next one is Mike Goodwin's, and so he's not here to talk about it, but I can read it off to everyone. Develop an incentive to city and county governments to incentivize housing developers to include a number of service-enriched housing units in conventionally financed projects. And then he gives an example, a formula for ad valorem tax exemption that is some multiple of the percentage of dedicated units, up to 20% of the total project. Local taxing jurisdictions can do about anything they want in this area. His words. And so this option would have some sort of tie or commitment from the service providers. Is there any discussion on this? I'm not quite sure how, you know, how the state agency can make this tie. You know, in terms of what we're recommending, you know, our recommendations have been mostly what state agencies can do. And this looks like a local taxing issue. Does anyone have any comments on that?
I think the only thing that you can do is, again, sometimes how what we're doing under the demonstration is, while we don't have any jurisdiction or authority over city and county governments any more than we have any jurisdiction or authority over the public housing authorities, is that at least we'll put in a recommendation that, you know, as these plans come up, you know, we review, you know, there's a mechanism for reviewing them and to ensure that other advocates or other individuals in the community go and petition to make this happen. And this is one of the goals that we would hope for them to achieve. I mean, I think that's the only way you can get around this without having some sort of legislative intervention.
I think if we could find a really good example of maybe somebody that's doing this, some city or locality that's doing it, it would be worthy to put in there as an example, and then as elected officials read it, they can, you know, take it to their city councils and whatnot, but that would be my only recommendation for that one.
Okay. And then I think that number 10 is kind of what we already talked about with 2C, which is, you know, utilizing mainstream housing developers and trying to gain their participation. I think we already went over that. Do you think there's anything else for recommendation number 10 that we need to talk about?
No, I think we pretty well covered that one from our previous discussion.
Okay. And then the last recommendation, number 11, that Mike Goodwin submitted was develop programs of local vouchers set aside for service-enriched housing vouchers within each housing jurisdiction in the state. There would have to be some incentive to get cities and counties to give up scarce general use vouchers. This may take effort and dollars up the food chain. That is something that has been an interesting topic recently, is how vouchers are being set aside. I know that there is the, you know, NOFA that was released for additional Section 8 vouchers that we're very interested in. And I guess this is trying to figure out how there could be working with the PHAs to see if there would be a service-enriched housing type voucher set aside in a way.
And that NOFA, it has to be on for a waiting list. So,
that's true.
Current waiting list.
That's true.
Like project, the people on that, they would be concluded in one of the categories would be included to get people out of institutions, but the other category is just housing in general for people with disabilities who are under 62. So, that's what that NOFA is about, but we have to work off our current waiting list. But that doesn't mean that there are probably people on our waiting list that we can identify somehow or another with using, I don't know, might win tied in somehow. I don't know. Great, we could. Because every PHA can apply, and us, I know we can apply for 100 vouchers based on what we've already been doing, and apply for up to 300 vouchers depending on how many they're already doing. A lot of PHAs, that's a lot of people in Texas, and I don't know who's doing that besides us.
Well, there's, I can tell you, because Steve Ashland's coordinating for the state, there are several other public housing authorities that are putting requests in. Some of them are going to be are viable, some of them aren't, because of the requirements that you, in order to get vouchers, you've had to demonstrate you've done vouchers. And so, for some people, they're just not going to be able to do it. But there are a couple of handfuls of people who PHAs that are going to be submitting applications.
So do we, in terms of this recommendation, I mean, do people think that it's realistic to have some type of service-enriched housing voucher kind of in the same vein as like a project access voucher, except for a different population?
Yeah, I think this, the basis of the recommendation, I think, is a very good one. And I was going to ask my own question, whether or not we can, whether this is a barrier to regulation or belongs in the obstacle section. You know, petitioning HUD to establish some vouchers that would be similar in kind, but not necessarily the same thing that this current NOFA is doing, to support the concept of development of the service of rich housing or housing stock or whatever we're calling it. So I think the general, the larger concept is a good concept.
All right. Well, that's all that was on the handout, but I wanted to give everyone an opportunity, now that we've, you know, kind of had this little brainstorming session and talked about other ideas, if there's any, if anyone has any additional ideas for policies that haven't been brought up yet that we want to cover.
I can't think of anything.
I can't think of anything either. I think this does a really good job of covering the waterfront.
Right. I'm thinking, the only thing that I'm just thinking back to our conference call on May 13th, and we were talking about, you know, both recommendations for policies and procedures, but also recommendations for like funding sources and utilizing funding sources or connecting funding sources to one another. And I don't know if maybe that's a conversation we want to have at our next conference call or, but maybe talk about funding and not just housing funding, but services funding too.
Ashley, do you mean, to sort of describe how the funding systems work currently?
I think that it was, and maybe people who are on the May 13th call can join in. I think that it was saying, you know, what's currently out there that could be accessed for the purposes of service-enriched housing. What are we not utilizing, you know, or what could we utilize for this purpose as well as other purposes?
Well, I mean, I would suggest, and I know this is for another conversation, and please stop me, but in terms of service dollars, when people are knowledgeable and aware, service dollars are there if they meet the eligibility criteria, they're not on an interest list, that. So the services, at least from the Medicaid perspective, and again, the state of Texas has, from a state perspective, has very limited general revenue programs, has very limited Older American Act dollars, has very limited block grant sort of dollars. The primary source for services is Medicaid. Now, Medicaid, again, only serves the very, 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 very poor, down to that, you know, 17-20% of average median income sort of poor. But you're also talking about what other jurisdictions, such as city and counties that we've already discussed, what they have to contribute to the mix. Now, maybe, again, that's an education issue where those linkages can be made. So, again, you know, just for my own clarification, what are we trying to get? Is this an education issue? Or because if someone's eligible, they can get services as long as they're aware that, you know, what those criteria are.
And Mark, this is maybe going a little bit off, but I think that, you know, maybe we need to also think about what barriers we identified when creating the identifying barriers chapter, and you know, a lot of the barriers we identified, which that dealt with Medicaid and services funding, dealt with the strict criteria, and do we want to make recommendations here at this point that have to do with making sure that there is a larger population that is in need that is eligible?
Yeah, I think it's always, again, to duplicate the statement, and certainly it's been very serious, and people understand, again, that it's an education issue, it's a funding issue, it's a lot of different issues, because in the Medicaid program, if we're talking about community-based programming, and we are primarily stuck with a Medicaid model, then for people who have a more intense service need, you need to have some of our waiver services versus some of our just more simple state plan amendment services, then funding is a very big issue, and funding will be a very big issue as we go into the 2011 legislative session. We have several thousand people, if not tens of thousands of people on wait lists paying for services. So it is longer saying that. I think a statement should or could be made in this area also.
I think that's a great idea. I think that, you know, even if we're reiterating what has been said in other plans, to say that is important.
Yeah, and again, this is another area, obviously, that there's a lot of overlap with promoting independence, and it needs to come from various sides of the coin that, you know, we can develop. I mean, it wouldn't be wonderful if we had all the housing out there, but we don't have all the services out there. You know, I mean, it's making sure that the both, that we're looking at this from a universal perspective and not siloed. And I think that was the whole point of the Housing Human Services Council, is making sure that it's working together in tandem and not from individual perspectives.
I think that's great. I think that that we should add that to this list of policy recommendations. And are there others? I guess Jonas, Jim, Mark, those of you from the health and human services side, can you think of any recommendations that we need to make sure we have in here that may not be, you know, ways of, you know, maybe kind of peripheral to these housing recommendations we've made, but are important in making sure that those who need the service assistance can also receive that as well as the affordable housing?
Yeah, one other thing, I don't know if we have our good friends here from State Health Services, so I need to speak for them since we do so many projects with them, is then certainly not only on the waiver side, but just basic behavioral health services are truly lacking, and we have to make sure that those services, too, are available.
I would agree with Mark's comment. You know, there are more services available for people with physical and developmental disabilities, depending on what their income is and what their circumstances are, but the service array for individuals with behavioral health is extremely limited.
It exists in them.
Yeah.
No, we're definitely, you and I are definitely on the same page, Jonas. I'm gonna, so it's so overall, maybe Jonas and I can get together or craft something for you, Ashley, and then everyone can look around and see if it makes sense.
I mean, I would love that you know, you guys having the expertise in that segment of what this council is trying to accomplish. If you guys had, you know, similar to the preliminary recommendations on housing that Gene and Mike came up with, if you had some of those for the services side, that would be great.
Okay, we will. Jonas and I will take it on together, and I'll craft something and share with him, and he can read your comments, and we'll send it together as a human service folk.
And Jim, too. Don't forget Jim.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And yeah, you should CC, even though Nick Doster from Dishes isn't on this seat. I think that'd be great. All right. I think that we are done with the discussion of the plan today. In terms of next steps, I'm going to be sending out an email this afternoon that has our June conference call schedule. The next conference call for this committee is Thursday, June 10th.
Okay, and Ashley?
Yes.
I will be on vacation that week and out of state.
Oh, Jonas.
Jonas, I hope you're doing something fun.
I am. I'm going to Washington, D.C. for fun.
Oh, good. Have a wonderful time.
I'm so excited.
I'm excited for you.
All right. Well, then I will hold you to submitting those service recommendations to me before that date. How about that?
Yes.
Ashley? Yes.
The 10th, you're talking in the morning?
Yes.
That's the doll meeting.
Oh, Kate. Well, the thing is, the good thing about this is I sit right next to Kate. And so we can figure that out. Because I think that's, you're right, we do need to make sure that we don't overlap with the DAW. So how about I will let you guys know what Kate, you know, Kate and I can talk about it. We can talk about it with the members of the DAW and figure out some way of not overlapping.
Okay.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, we were, it's just the thing on the disaster funding.
I know, I will be there.
Yeah, so.
All right, great. Well, I will make sure that we don't overlap with the DAW.
Great.
All right. And in terms of chapters, I send out everyone a background chapter that basically just has to do with the activities of the council in approaching this biennial plan, and then also a needs assessment chapter, which is all of the quantitative data that I was given either through the public forum process or through recommendations by the council members, and so it's kind of putting together a assessment of need for the populations that we're looking to serve. So those two chapters were submitted to you on Tuesday, and we're not required for this meeting, but I did want everyone to look at them and give feedback on those chapters. Also, the Chapter 5, Identifying Barriers, is completed, and I'm just waiting for the green light from my supervisor, and I will send that out to you guys so you can also see that chapter. And I've incorporated some changes from our last conference call, which dealt with any of the tweaks to the preamble to the Chapter 3 on Defining Service Rich Housing and to the Profiles Appendix. And so those have been updated based on your comments and feedback. And so, yeah, so we're chugging along here with the writing of everything, and hopefully I'll be able to give you guys more substantial chunks of the plan soon. So that's where staff is. Is there any other outstanding comments, questions, concerns?
Ashley, I'm sorry, I had to go on and get another call. So are we having the June 10th meeting or not?
We are. I'm just probably going to change the time on it, and I will make sure everyone's aware.
Okay, if you can do that as soon as possible because calendars are filling up.
Okay, I definitely will. I will talk to Kate today. All right, great. Thank you so much, everyone.
All righty.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.